Or do we have to do a program, or could we just listen to this music? I vote we listen to the music and have ourselves a party. But, okay, it is Free Your Mind Friday, so we have to accommodate all the thoughts that are on people's minds today. That was the Soweto String Quartet with Millennia. This is from their 2008 music video, believe it or not, filmed in Johannesburg. This is Lead Stories. I'm Beatrice Lead. And as I said, it's Free Your Mind Friday. What is Free Your Mind Friday? Well, you get things that are on your mind or have been on your mind off your mind. But you should be using the time to talk about things that matter, things that you think people ought to be pondering or you would like to share. It is not chit-chat. It's not a chit-chat time. It is really for the exchange of information. And hopefully you have good information to share, and that's the point. It's really not important whether people agree or disagree. Everybody likes the idea that people agree with you with what you say. But that's not what Free Your Mind Friday is all about. You have a point of view about a particular issue or event. You present your point of view. And then, you know, you throw caution to the wind. People may like it, people may not. But that's not important. That's not the reason you're doing what you're doing. You're doing what you're doing because somebody needs to say something about a particular issue or event, and that's you, and you're prepared. We are listening, by the way, for how prepared you are. We're listening. We want to hear that you have done some kind of research, that you have some logical line in your reasoning, and that's all we can ask. And let people decide whether it was worth listening to you or not. 888-874-4888 is the number to call. 888-874-4888. It's Free Your Mind Friday on Lead Stories. Imagine that, a whole program devoted just to listeners' calls. Where else are you going to get that except on PRN? Where else? You tell me. All right, who's up first? Let's see. I want to get my... Henry from Chicago. You're up first. How'd you manage that?
I don't know. I'm lucky I got on today.
Hello, Henry. How are you?
All right. We're enduring some rain here. I think the whole country's enduring some monsoon rain going on because I hear different parts of the country.
We're getting some here, too. So what's on your mind that you're freeing it up today?
All right. Well, I want to wish everybody, you included, PRN, Lead Stories listeners, a great, safe, and productive weekend.
Thank you.
I want to go back to the topic that you mentioned earlier in the week about gifted students and education. And it's okay. So funny. It's like when I started listening, you know, when I was meditating on some of the responses of the callers that were said, and I was like, some of them were like, I've heard that before. Then I went back to my library and picked up The Miseducation of the Negro by Carter G. Woodson. I'm like, that's where I heard some of what the callers are responding about. And I don't know if the callers have read the book. Maybe some of them have, maybe some of them haven't. But if you haven't and you were interested in the topic that you were talking about earlier in the week about gifted students in the institutional educational system, Carter G. Woodson, who wrote that book in 1933, still has relevant points that we have to analyze and figure out today in 2021. That's what makes that book so timeless. And I believe you can get it free online, you know, if you do some digging. But I thought that was very, very interesting when you brought up that topic, because of the fact that institutional education, as I like to call it, it does something to folks in a sense where, as Carter G. Woodson puts it, it individualizes them as special people. And mind you, Carter G. Woodson, who was educated in an Ivy League school himself, and I think it was Princeton, wrote about this and how he had to uneducate himself, not in the context of what it was taught, but how he was to use this particular knowledge that he gained, and not for the benefit of the people. And it all goes back to the roots of who were you raised by. They always say that your first teachers are typically your parents and how you were rooted, because not all, you know, just because you've been educated in Ivy League institutions does not mean that, you know, you've been brainwashed to think like, you know, white Ivy League, you know, or the white aligned way of thinking. Because, I mean, we've had, you know, guys like Carter G. Woodson, who realized that, you know, he's been miseducated, and he used his knowledge for the purposes of, you know, of black people. And then you look at modern day scholars like, you know, Dr. Horn. Dr. Horn was educated in an Ivy League institution, but he doesn't use it, you know, in a way where it's not beneficial to the people. So, you know, the thing is, and it's so interesting, I mentioned Dr. Horn. There's a biography series that he's doing with another person talking about his life and how his mother was an activist, his sisters were activists. So it was like Dr. Horn was rooted in that particular setting. So it didn't matter if he, you know, was educated at, you know, a local city college or the Ivy League. Dr. Horn, he was going to be who he was going to be. And so just like, with Dr. Horn, people who have not been educated, you know, institutionally educated, does not mean that they don't have valuable knowledge. You take somebody like who I think is one of the greatest historians of our time, and you call him your mentor, Dr. John Henry Clark. And he was not in a institutional education, but this guy taught classes at an Ivy League institution. Because they figured that what he knew was beneficial to them, and what he knew was very vast and knowledgeable, even though, like I said. And then you think of people like Malcolm X and Fannie Lou Hamer, guys, people who were sharp, very sharp, and they knew their stuff, even though they weren't formally educated or formally educated in these institutions. So we have to think of the paradigm of how we educate our children and be involved in that. I know my daughter, who goes to a private school, I have to always ask her, what have they been teaching you in that school? And she tells me. So sometimes I have to correct some of these teachings that they tell her, you know, because, you know, that if you don't step in to, you know, educate your children in a way where they take this education and help their people out, yeah, they're going to move away, and they're going to, you know, some of them become white identified, you know, scholars, even though they look black. But, you know, they have to, we have to get them away from what Carter G. Woodson was telling us almost 100 years ago about what these institutions are really educating our students on.
Well, thank you for getting us started today so robustly. Thank you, Henry, for calling in.
Thank you.
And have a good weekend. Thank you.
You too.
Harvey from Berkeley, you're on the air.
Hello, most excellent Utrice.
Hello, most excellent Harvey. What are you talking about today, most excellently?
Well, much love to you and your worldwide audience. And for us living in
Thank
and around
you.
The San Francisco Bay Area, There used to be a talk show host, a guy by the name of Ray Taliaferro. Utrecht, did you ever meet or know Ray Taliaferro?
No, I never met him.
Okay. Well, Ray was an American of African descent, and he was so gifted, a true genius. He was an accomplished pianist as well as a vocalist and choral conductor. Ray started and conducted the Ray Tal Chorale and also headed up the San Francisco Art Commission for 16 years. Ray was also the president of the San Francisco chapter of the NAACP from 1968 to 1971. And in 1975, he helped found the National Association of Black Journalists. But these are a few of his many accomplishments, but he also kept many of us who lived in Northern California awake from 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. With his Monday through Friday talk show on KGO Radio. And my day would begin at 1 a.m. with Ray's early show, as he called it. And at 5, when Ray signed off, I'd grab a nap until around 8 o'clock, and then I'd start my normal day. And the reason I'm talking about Ray Taliaferro on Free Your Mind Friday is that he had a saying that always stuck with me. And the saying was, it's nice to be nice. Simple on the surface, yet revolutionary in concept. With so many forces working to create a stressful environment, it's a wonder that the majority of us can and do maintain our composure through it all. Simply put, we're kept on a diet of perpetual war, the war on crime, the war on drugs, the war on poverty. There are but three of the domestic wars with North America as the battleground. It used to be that the scary enemies were the Soviet Union, China, and Korea, and they still are. But now, because of the COVID, everybody's the enemy. And I say, how sad. Add face masks, social distancing, self-incarceration, vax passports, and economic uncertainty to America's perpetual domestic and foreign wars, and what do you get? A whole lot of additional stress. Everybody, especially people who watch mainstream media, are stressed to the max. It's as though the forces that be are like vampires sucking the everyday joy of life out of us 24/7, year in and year out. And from the moment we get up in the morning, the message is be afraid, be very afraid. And we know that too much stress is the harbinger of depression and illness. It weakens our immune system. That's why Ray's It's Nice to Be Nice message is so important during this time of relentless negative news. It's the people in our lives that we see and speak to every day. A warm gesture, and I say, don't allow the system of hate and fear to ruin your day or your fellow Earthlings' day. Now's the time for a new philosophy. And It's Nice to Be Nice is a great way to show respect and love for others, especially during this time of media manufactured division. Thank you, wonderful Utrecht.
Thank you, wonderful Harvey. That was a wonderful little lesson that you conducted there, and with great purpose. It's nice to be nice. It really does bring the tension level down. And you can feel much better as you go about your day. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Donnie from Georgia, you're on the air.
Hello, Hotep, Utrecht.
Hotep.
I wish you forgive me, but I would like to kind of break it, the conversation today, just because it's special to me. I would like to give a shout out to a very great man who happens to be my father. He turned 100 the 22nd of this month. And I would like to give a shout out. He's a very wonderful man. And I just like to give him that shout out. He was married. And unfortunately, my mother's not here. She died about six years ago, but they were married for 65 years. And, he raised four kids. He has countless grandkids and countless great-grandkids. None of them has ever been to jail. None of them got pregnant before they got their diplomas. All of them have college degrees. So I would like to shout out to him. I'd like the world to know about him, how great he was. Thank you.
Thank you. And congratulations to your conjuring up this memory. This is very important. It's a way of continuing.
Well, he's still alive. He's still alive. My mother's the one that passed away.
Yes, you said that. But I'm saying it's a great way to continue the knowledge of where you come from. And it anchors you when you have a place that you could go, even if it's a historical place. You have a point of reference for your life. Thank you very much for calling in and contributing.
Can I say one more thing?
Gwen from New York, you're on the air.
Hi, Yatrice. How are you feeling?
I'm having a ball. How about you?
I am having a whirlwind morning, and I just wanted to say I loved Harvey's share, and I wanted to throw in that another nice thing to ask is, how do you feel today? So so I started off with you. I was on another channel this morning that I never get asked. I can never get in on this channel, WNYC. And I think, well, they screen their calls very heavily. And I was really surprised that I was able to get in. The topic of the show was a woman doctor who was talking about the urgent need to have your five-year-old child vaccinated. And, you know, she's talking she's making her case, and she's saying, now, 7 or 8% of children will get COVID. Now, that's really, really far out there, and because things that come first are things like colds and flus and all the other stuff. So 8 ranks almost all the way in the back. And she was saying that, you know, what it would bring the children was maybe a feeling of having a bad cold. And I called in because I wanted to know if that really outweighed the vaccine's harmful effects that have been documented and studied. And, I said, because to me, I said, you're putting your most precious thing out there, and that's your child. And I said, this vaccine is still in an experimental stage. It's still not, they're not finished with the experiments. It won't be done for 4 years. So I said, I think if you're in a grown up and you're an adult and you want to take that chance and do that, that's fine. But you want to take the most precious thing in your life, and that's your child, and you want to put that needle in there, and you don't really know what's going to happen. Now, this woman also said that there was no problem with the vaccine because all vaccines, you'll see a reaction within 2 months. And I had to remind her that this is not a vaccine, that, in fact, this is a messenger RNA vaccine, which is different from anything else and everything else that's out there. So we actually don't know how long it will take before we see reactions. So, I was in there a little longer, and Brian Lehrer said, well, have you had your vaccines? And I have. And I told him, I said, I had every vaccine that my mother had me take when I was a child. And then he asked me, well, is there anything in anybody that that, had a problem with vaccines? And I said, well, yeah, and a matter of fact, in my family, we have an autistic nephew. And I said, it has really torn our family apart. It's been a lot more than what anybody could really realize. And I said, I think it was about that time that I began to question things. I never said no. I just started to look at things and question and wonder whether or not, the arguments were valid about not taking vaccines. And I'm still not a person that would tell you not to take every vaccine, but I would say be very careful. But that was the aha moment for Brian Lehrer. So he didn't say it to me while I was on the air. The last thing I want to say is that I also asked the doctor this. I said, is it really worth the injuries of getting brain inflammation, heart inflammation, or blood clots? Is getting not having a little cold worth, those kind of things that we've seen that show up in children who have had the vaccine? And she didn't, after they got off the phone, of course, they don't answer me on the phone. I got off the phone, and they were very first. The aha moment was, well, you see, we debunked that a long time ago about the autism. In fact, it has not been debunked. OK, there's a lot of information out there from the CDC itself. that said there were studies over the last 10-year period of time that actually documented that the vaccines they were giving children at that time for mumps were giving way to getting autism. So it's not true. But, you know, when you talk to these people, it's like it's this one long propaganda line. And it's really upsetting because anybody that gets in, as soon as you get off the phone, they talk to you as if you first I was a screaming meanie because I questioned things after my own family got autism after taking the shot. And then she started to talk as if she kind of felt sorry for me because I was uninformed. I'm anything but uninformed. I listen to the propaganda every single day, and it never changes. It's just one long, unchanged story since the very beginning. And I listen to Gary Noll and other people, and I hear lots of credible people with credible documents to back them up that are saying, no, this is what else is happening. This is how it's changed, and every day we learn a little bit more. Because actually there are people are interested in learning more about what it is we're sticking in our veins. And the story changes every day. Basically what WMIC and WBAI are propagating is a dead story. Every day it's one dead story, one dead fish after the next dead fish. It never changes. And I was so disappointed to hear Doug Henwood on this morning. We are New York, we're at a crossroads with the unions up here who are saying they will not go for this mandate. And they are paying people $500 a piece to take it. If this is such a fabulous product, why would you have to pay anybody? But the fact that they're paying so much money to make people take this vaccine and then tell them, as of tonight at 5 o'clock, you will not have a job anymore. This is really serious stuff. And so this is what's on my mind right now, because I can only think of what's next and how disappointed I am in the media for propagating this story and not having any changes added to it or any other voices come to the table. I'm sure if Gary Noll can come up with these people, I'm pretty sure that WMYC should be able to put them out there. So it's very disappointing. And the last thing I wanted to say, I'm going to keep that for later, but I just wanted to put that out there today and say that I'm going to try to get down if there are any protests today and support the people that are fighting against the mandate and fighting against losing their jobs, because I think it's really important that whether you're for the vaccine or not for the vaccine, that you go down and stand with people who stand to lose their job. They want to make up their own mind about this. So if you're in New York today, there's probably going to be a rally in Foley Square, and maybe we should all stand with these people.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks for your contribution today, Gwen. Thank you. Mitch from New York, you're on the air.
You were speaking last week, or the first of the week, about the opioid crisis and how people are getting addicted to it and how people have passed away. There's another crisis in our community that nobody is really talking about. Johnson & Johnson, they've been putting out a product, talcum powder, and baby powder, which has asbestos in it, and it's causing cancer in women, ovarian cancer. Now, how many people have died over the year from ovarian cancer? Over 20,000 women have been diagnosed with it. Now, there's been a lawsuit passed. I mean, they went to court. They took Johnson & Johnson to court. And, they get a settlement. Well, they say, we'll set aside $4 billion for any lawsuits that's coming through for this ovarian cancer that women are getting, which is deadly. But what Johnson & Johnson have done, they're going to set up a separate company, they say, and they're going to put all the lawsuits in that company, and then they'll go bankrupt with that company, so therefore, if there is a settlement in the lawsuit, people would hardly get nothing at all. That's criminal. And nobody is going to jail. Nobody's going to jail. Nobody's going to be punished. They don't mind paying out a couple of $1 billion because they just write it off on their taxes. So that seems to be the way it's done here in this country, you know, with corporations. They don't care really about people. I hear Johnson & Johnson, now they have a COVID tests that they're putting out too, you know, that they're clouding. But, you know, it's something to think about, you know.
What would you suggest?
Well, nobody is going to jail. Somebody, if these CEOs, you know, some say, well, you're the CEO, you know asbestos was being put in this powder that have been really marketed towards black people. I know when I was growing up, everybody had baby powder and talcum powder. When we went on a vacation, that went in the suitcase with us. But the CEO should go to jail if it's found out that your product has caused damage to so many people, just putting money out there and you go on, you're making all your billions of dollars every year, somebody should go to jail. Somebody should be punished.
Okay.
That's what I feel.
Thank you. Thanks so much for your call today. I hope we get some more reaction based on what you have offered us today. Thanks a lot. Mohammed from New York, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Eutrice.
Hello.
I hope all is well with you. I would just like to make a comment from the other day about education and the gifted schools. And I would like to say this, and I say this as having been a teacher in many different, organization, institution. I work for the Board of Ed. I work for the juvenile detention center called Spotford up in the Bronx. And I was a teacher there. And I'll tell you, that was so enlightening. Working with those young men there, most of them had had problems in their early life in education. And what I discovered with my own experience is when you to have them to learn or motivate them to learn, you have to make the lessons exciting. You have to excite their interest. And one thing that really gave me a natural high or professional gratitude was one day one of the counselors came back when she brought the students back, and she pulled me to the side. She said, "I have something to tell you." And I said, "What is that?" She said, "This young man, he said he never liked school in his life, but since he's been in your class, he likes school, and he can't wait to get back after lunch." And the key was exciting their interest. And when you see them struggle with things like, say, an equation, or you see them struggling with, say, one of the eight parts of speech, like an adverb or adjective, and once they get it, you can see the frustration on their faces. And then when they are able to understand it, you can see the joy that come over them. And to see that is, I tell you, it's a real professional gratification. It's a natural high just to see those young men learn. And I'll close with this. One young man came and told me, he said, "If I knew I was this smart," he said, "I'd never been in here, you know." Thank you very much for hearing me.
Thank you. Thanks for calling in.
You're welcome.
Bob from Virginia, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Latrice, and everybody listening.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
I hope you all stay well. I want to make two comments on two different callers, but I'll make it quick. So here goes. About the two people that said things about education and education starting in the home. When parents start expressing interest in education and the interest in what their students are learning, they will be interested. A teacher does not have to be exciting. Look at Sesame Street, one of the most successful, actually I worked on the show, one of the most successful educational programs that ever was written. It wasn't exciting, but it conveyed interest. If the parents in the home show interest in what the students are learning at home, the students will pick up on that, and those are the things they will be drawn to. If the parents show interest in basketball and football, that's what the children will be drawn to. So that's my first comment. The second comment is about this gentleman that spoke about asbestos in baby powder. I was part of a research about 12 years ago that was looking at the early illness detection. And we found out something we thought was astounding. 92% of everybody who has cancer has high levels of asbestos in their body. Asbestos isn't only in baby powder. We found asbestos in 50 different brands of water. The amount of asbestos was under the level regulated by the FDA, but they need to lower those numbers. There are only 1.5 brands we found that never have asbestos in them. We can't figure out why, but we know that these two brands never have asbestos in them. One never has asbestos. The other one sometimes does, sometimes doesn't. But all the other brands, 48 other brands, all had regularly asbestos in them. The problem with making a regulation for asbestos is asbestos is very hard to measure. But that's not our problem. Our problem is making sure that the federal regulators are concerned about what affects us and our health. And just to close it off, can anybody tell me what the largest cause of, maybe your tree should want to answer, what's the largest cause of death in children, say 1 to 4 year olds?
What's the largest? I'm sorry, I didn't get that word.
The largest cause of death in, say, 1 to 4 year olds.
I don't know off the top of my head. I'll have to look it up.
Take a guess. Anything. What do you think?
Largest cause of death in 1 to 4 year olds. I don't know. I couldn't say.
Would you say automobile accidents, accidents around the home, disease, illnesses,
okay.
Heart attacks?
Okay, I get it. I get that.
Okay. It's drowning. It's drowning. Drowning over exceeds any other cause of death, and yet you don't see people yelling and screaming and causing, you know, you need a green card or you have to teach swimming in the elementary school. Or now New York City, I found out, is mandating CPR training for 7th graders in public school, not in private school, in public schools. So everybody is drawn by the media to focus on different things, and now they're focusing on COVID, whatever. COVID deaths in children is like so low in the scale. I mean, why are they even bothering to try to vaccinate people? 75 million children in this country and only 303 deaths over the whole course of COVID in the past 18 months. And 300 of those are children who had pre-existing conditions. So we have to reassess our priorities. That's what my whole contribution today is. And I hope everybody stays well. And just so.
Thank you so much for your contribution. Thank you. Well, we'll take this little break and come back with more because we have people lined up, ready to go, right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm your Tree Sleed, and we continue today's program, which is Free Your Mind Friday. The program is all about your calls and what is concerning you more than anything else at this time. And people are free to react or to add to it or to comment on it. It's about giving you the space to also express a point of view. Brother David from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, you Trace.
Good afternoon.
A couple days back, you had a program where you wanted people to relate to things that the president should do, that we would look forward to him doing. And I thought a lot about that, and that motivated me to get to a number of things. Before I start, I will say that I have spent a number of years as a lifeguard, and I think that swimming is very important. And if you don't teach your child to swim, that's child abuse. I've saved a number of lives as a lifeguard. I'm very happy that I was able to do that. Getting to what I wanted to free my mind about, I thought about things like in the case of the president, what I would like him to do is stop the sanction warfare that he's taking all around the world, sanctioning different companies for different countries for various reasons. That's really a form of warfare when you do sanctions. I'd like to see him leave Julian Assange alone, the journalist, and stop trying to persecute him, or they could say prosecute him, and stop the policy of the United States government, which is to search for enemies. That is a policy that's been done for a long time to keep the military industrial process enriching itself by you searching for enemies. You always need enemies. And recently, the last couple of days, they talked about the hypersonic weapons of the Chinese. That's a good propaganda move, because that will motivate people to increase the so-called defense, or I'd say war budget. So that's another thing. And what I would also add to that list is expand the reserves. The military needs to be reduced, and most of the military should be in reserve units, and get rid of all these bases and troops all over the world and take it way down and have mainly reserves and do that. That's a very important thing. In addition, they always talk about veterans. But during the Bush administration, Bush took 800,000 veterans away from getting VA benefits at the VA hospital centers. That was a terrible thing to deny veterans that support that they always have had before. In addition, I think the president should really stop support of countries with vicious dictators or apartheid states that we support with our tax dollars. We have to stop that thing. Another thing that I think I want to get off my mind is that people who take government jobs should not be allowed to do a revolving door number with corporations, either going from a corporation to a government position and then back again to a corporation. And I think that is wrong, and that should be ended. As far as I'm concerned, we need a policy where everyone in the country is guaranteed some job. And I think that that could be done. If you don't have a job with a private corporation or a private job, there ought to be some government job, just like during the Great Depression when Franklin Roosevelt did that. As far as I'm concerned, there should be no such thing as a school loan. Schools should be free, and that's the way I see it. As far as weapons are concerned, I would get rid of all nuclear weapons. And that, I think, would benefit people all over the world. When it comes to voting, the change I would make is for national office, there should be a national voting law. And it shouldn't be left just to states. When you deal with national offices, there should be national rules that would apply everywhere. With schools, as I have thought about it, I would make schools free. All schools would be free, and I think that would be best, and we could do that. with the Social Security system, I think Social Security should be available, full Social Security, for people by the time they get to 60, and it has to be improved to this point where it's a good retirement system. If the people in the Congress have a wonderful system, the people in the masses of the people in the United States should have a good system also. I think that we need to improve our social benefits. We need a policy to take care of our elders, elder care system that is would improve, and we should do that. We should have banking for our postal system so people will not be wedded to these rapacious commercial banks. And with health care, dental care should be included, and health care should not be tied to someone's job. Health care should be for all the citizens who live here. I'd make it possible also to put in a law that would say that we should have term limits. We shouldn't have these professional politicians that stay forever and don't serve the needs of the people. And elections, as elections be publicly financed all over. Many things that have been put in by those backward people in Congress, so things like the Taft-Hartley law, that should be revoked. That the Taft-Hartley law is a law against workers, and we've had all kinds of administrations in, Democrat, Republican, and they've let that law stay there. So that's one of the reasons that union membership has gone way down, because the ruling class wanted that law. So we need a law that rescinds the Taft-Hartley law for the good of the workers. The system of lobbying should be
wait a minute,
ended.
Bill. How long is your list?
I only got a few more things to go. It's a long list, but we need a lot of things.
Yes, I know.
Yeah, so that's the way I see it. And the things that I think are really important, I think the utilities ought to be controlled by the public, not put into private hands, because everybody needs a utility, you know, electricity and that sort of thing. So that's the way I see it, and that's a part of the list that I looked at when you motivated me to get to the point where I wanted to see some changes.
Well, I tell you, this is a very impressive list, and really, it wouldn't hurt us one bit if we get some of these things underway as soon as possible. It wouldn't hurt a bit. It
Amen.
Would help immensely. Thank you so much for calling in today and contributing.
Thank
Marcus
you.
Marcus from Wisconsin, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Utrice. Thanks for letting me join the forum as usual. I have kind of a difficult subject. It's difficult to talk about, but I'll make a stab at it. People usually respond very emotionally to this, regardless of their political orientation. Of course, you've probably gathered from since I've had the pleasure of being able to talk with you, that my main concern is finding a way for us to do something about this system. What we do mostly and have done most of my life is symbolic protest that really has next to zero effect. So I have tried to make it my task for going on 50 years now to try and get people to understand that these are dead ends. And I just want to discuss that with you and your audience a little bit. I mean, do people think what's happening in Yemen and Syria and what we're doing, what we've been doing in Afghanistan and Iraq all this time is some sort of joke? These are atrocious examples for everybody in the world of how determined our imperialist rich are to commit genocide at any level against people if nothing else serves their desired results. So if you don't agree here in the United States to the new market setup, or if Yemen doesn't agree to adopt the military bases they want there or become sources of raw materials or cheap labor, you get stomped into the grave. Now, I'm afraid I've been watching most of my life our opportunistic left, which explains the New York Attorney General you were talking about earlier in the week. Yeah. Here in the metropole, it's opportunism. We behave idiotically because we can't admit that we benefit from this genocide and this theft and this coercion and this warfare. We sit and we gab. We are what Lenin defined as the labor aristocracy. We're generally the more well-to-do layers of the working class. You know, we're not digging for roots with our fingers every day. We have, you know, TVs and cars. And but what Lenin meant by that is we no longer have any incentive to engage in the dangerous task of carrying out a revolution against capitalism. And as Lenin explained, and I'm no Marxist, but I mean, I think any literate person should at least make themselves familiar with it. As he explained, all the profits earned from this exploitation from these countries is used to pay for the elevated position of certain sections of the working class here in, you know, what's called the metropole. Now, I don't think it's impossible for the left to actually reclaim something of their, say, late 19th century political identity, you know, real anti-fascism, anti-authoritarianism wherever it exists. And obviously, it's the agenda of both political parties at every level. Real anti-imperialist action, if we begin to remember the actual results of what this system produces. Auschwitz and the Japanese internment and the endless wars we've been at and supporting and benefiting from, we are complicit in this. And so whenever I've heard people, particularly on the left, who adopt this attitude of, well, we have to pity the poor masses and the disenfranchised, I think we're being reactionary without realizing it. You cannot relieve people of the responsibility that they have toward them. I think this kind of pity is actually pseudo-revolutionary. Everybody at every level pays dearly for intellectual dishonesty. It's not that the millions of people here in the United States, you know, occupying their time with TV and celebrity hairdos, don't sense and don't know what's involved. it's not true that it's impossible for people to actually exploit the opportunities presented by even a fake democracy to make actual change. The problem as I see it, and it's true of all of us, I think, and we have to be honest enough to admit it, I believe, is we're simply too chicken-hearted and cowardly to spout openly about this in the way we're willing to spout nonsense openly. You know, pity is an elitist attitude. Who's supposed to save people anyway? Nobody's capable of that. Whoever promises to save you will be your downfall. Either people as a species will learn to be responsible, or they'll continue to be slaughtered. And in a sense, almost rightly so. I mean, if somebody pulls a knife on me and I just simply refuse to see it because I'm frightened, then I'm going to get stabbed in the stomach. I'm a fool. Nobody can spare me that, or save me, or comfort me over it. I simply have to see the threat, register it, and dispose of it by whatever process is necessary to do that. Now, that can be done collectively. There are lots and lots of examples in human history of people organizing around the project of doing that. But I think we are immobilized by our cowardice and reliance on reflexive rhetoric that doesn't really mean anything. We talk about, well, this resonates with me, and, you know, I'm making a difference and taking it to the next level, and all of this nonsense that doesn't have any objective meaning in the real world. And I think we have to get beyond that and begin by looking at ourselves in the mirror and realizing whatever tyranny and authoritarianism is in our faces at the moment, we are enabling it. It's our job to stop it. No system is going to do that for us. So I think this is, for me, I have recognized what I believe is the proof of this, that it actually exists most of my life. And my experience is nobody of any political orientation or racial group or religious group wants to hear this. They'll do everything in their power to avoid this, what to me is just an obvious reality, not because I'm smart or something like that. I'm not, but simply because in my own personal life, over and over, I've had to face this or be consumed by my own self-destructive tendencies. And I think this is what's playing out collectively. I really appreciate your letting me just sort of riff on this with you.
Well, because it's so profound. We have no choice, it seems to me, but to listen when we are being told the truth. We have to stop and listen. And I want to thank you for bringing this to our attention today in the way that you have. Because, you know, you're not doing it to be mean, of course. You are telling us the truth and bringing us back to a point of reference in terms of where we ought to be as opposed to where we think we are. Thank you so much for that.
Thank you, Eugene. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you all for contributing so meaningfully today. And I'm going to go back and read my notes and fashion future programs out of exactly what you said today. Thank you all. Have a good weekend. Surround yourselves with people who bring good things into your life, who add dimension to your life, and make sure you carve some time out to spend with the people who are meaningful in your life. And then get ready for the battle again, starting next week. Bye-bye.